Good day. My name is Douglas Wilson. This is the Plodcast. It's also episode 319 of the Plodcast. You are most welcome. Thank you for coming. So today I want to talk about that vexed phrase, Christian nationalism, and I want to talk about it in the context of the election. This is because, as it now appears, the Democrats are going to try to tag all opposition to President Biden as a resurgent Christian nationalism. They're going to want to make that the scarecrow of the election, all right? Because everybody knows that if you vote for Christian nationalists, you're going to wind up in, find yourself in the middle of the Handmaid's Tale. So that's what this is going to be. Christian nationalism is the scarecrow. Now, that means that people on our side, meaning roughly those who would rather be dead in a ditch than to vote for President Biden, are going to have to sort some things out, because every last one of us, every mother's son, is going to be called a Christian nationalist. And so for your to help you in your cataloging efforts, I want to submit to you that there are three different kinds of Christian nationalists. Three different kinds of Christian nationalists. All of us are CN now. Don't try to fight it. But there are three different kinds. There are the people who think that Christian nationalism is the greatest concept and the greatest name ever. Sign me up. You had me at Christian nationalist. All you have to do is state that this is the position. We want our nation to be Christian, and we want it to be called Christian nationalism that got us there. That's group one. All right, that's group one. Group two of the Christian nationalists are people who are willing, let us call them the yes, but Christian nationalists. The yes, but Christian nationalists. They are willing to carry the label, they're willing to be called that, and they're willing to defend the concept of Christian nationalism, provided they are given 2 minutes at the front end to explain what it is and is not. They are the yes, but Christian nationalists. I would be in this category. I prefer Christian nationalism to the other names I've been called, like white supremacist or theofascist or Christofascist or neo-Nazi. Those other names are not redeemable, and there's no sense trying to redeem them. But Christian nationalist has certain scary overtones because it makes people think of Nazis and goose-stepping soldiers and missile parades and dictators with sunglasses. That the word nationalism conjures all of that up because the Nazis had nationalist in their party name. But they also had socialist in their party name, and that doesn't appear to be slowing Bernie Sanders down, not even a little bit. So I think that if you gave me 2 minutes without interrupting, I could explain that our societies are going to be organized either on a globalist level or a nationalist level or a tribalist level. It's either going to be global, national, or tribal. And I much prefer the nation, the setup of nations. And given those nations, I would like those nations to not make God angry through their behavior. And God wrote a book telling us what sorts of things make him angry. And if we follow that book, if we submit ourselves to the scriptures, then that's going to be Christian nationalism. So that's a yes, but Christian nationalist. Then the third group. The third group is, we'll call them the kicking and screaming Christian nationalists. The kicking and screaming Christian nationalists are the people who insist that they are not Christian nationalists, not by any stretch of the imagination, but every major media outlet in the country is going to be calling them Christian nationalists. This was indicated by that recent Talking Heads segment on MSNBC, where that lady, Heidi Pirzabala, said that anybody who believed that our rights came from God, not from Congress and not from the Supreme Court, anybody who believed that our rights came from God, was that person was a Christian nationalist. So they've cast the net pretty broadly. They've cast the net pretty wide. And there'll be a large group of Christians, conservatives and other Christians, who are going to be called Christian nationalists. And they are going to be called that whether or not they're Christian and whether or not they've ever adopted the label of nationalist. They are opposed to Biden and whatever it is he's up to, or these days it'd probably be better to say whatever it is his handlers are up to. They're opposed to that, and that's all that it takes to be a Christian nationalist. So I would say, look, if you're in that third group, the kicking and screaming Christian nationalists, I would edit your objections down to half a minute or so, so that when someone calls you that, you can do all your respectable growling at the front end, and your growling and disavowing at the front end. And then after that, engage with the issues. Our rights do come from God. We are to be governed by the Constitution and not by the whims of our overlords and so on. So here's your handy template. The people, Christian nationalists, who think that it's going to be the greatest thing ever, they wanted to be signed up right away. Then there's the yes, but Christian nationalists, and I'd be in that group. And then there are the kicking and screaming Christian nationalists. One last thing about it. If anti-Semites and other unsavory sorts come into this territory and establish control over it in sort of a squatter's rights sort of way, if it becomes not racist because of accusations from the left, because they think everything is racist, but where it becomes actually a problem, it's actually true anti-Semitism or true bigotry, then, of course, at some point, we might want to abandon it and say, okay, let's not call ourselves that. But right now, it's a term that is preeminently usable, and I think that we should try to use it. It's going to be used on us at any rate. Always will be God. So, continuing the podcast, episode 319, we are coming back still, back in our seats in the hamartiology class of ours. Are we never going to graduate? And we're still in the K's. So, as you should know by now, we're looking at the different words that the New Testament uses to describe different kinds of sins. Our word this week is katadulao, which means to bring into bondage or to enslave. Katadulao. So, in all the ordinary uses, this would represent a very serious sin. Man-stealing, for example, that's a different word, but man-stealing is listed in 1 Timothy 1:10, alongside a number of other sins that are contrary to sound doctrine. The only exception would be when a person is brought out of his slavery to sin by means of enslavement to Christ, which is a metaphor that Paul uses in Romans 6, 17 and 18. But that use is only jarring if we've forgotten God's gracious intention of making all of his slaves into sons and daughters. So the Apostle Paul describes himself as a doulos, and that word is embedded in our verb here, as a doulos, as a slave of Christ, but he is a slave who cries out, Abba, Father. So, that said, there are two instances of our particular word for sin today, this word being used to describe a sinful behavior. The first is found in 2 Corinthians. For ye suffer if a man bring you into bondage, if a man devour you, if a man take of you, if a man exalt himself, if a man smite you on the face. 2 Corinthians 11:20. Here, the sinfulness of a false teacher is simply assumed, and the sin being targeted is the sin of allowing yourself to be enslaved. So, we see the sinfulness of the enslaving, but the center of the target is the Corinthian church, where they were allowing themselves to come under bondage, allowing themselves to be enslaved. Why are you putting up with that? Paul asks. The sinfulness of the false teacher is seen in all of his activities, that are mentioned here, devouring, robbing, puffing himself up, striking people in the face, and also, and here's our word, also enslaving them. And there's a peculiar counterpart to this sin, which is the sin of letting people do it. And this is also worth talking about. There's a particular kind of person, an emotional bully and sometimes an actual physical bully, who maintains control of people by abusing them. There are some people who try to control others by flattery or by bribery and, you know, sort of pleasant things. But there's a certain kind of person who sneers at the food you offer them, who sneers at the book recommendation you offer them. And it, it puts a certain kind of person always on their heels, always feeling like they have to please that person. And so they redouble their efforts to please him. And it's just emotional manipulation. So the false teachers at Corinth were like that on steroids. So false teachers attempted the same thing at Jerusalem when Paul had brought Titus there. No one gave way to the demand that Titus, as a Gentile, be circumcised. That would have amounted to enslavement to the entirety of the law, and that was antithetical to the genius of the gospel message. So here's that verse. And that because of false brethren unawares brought in, who came in privily to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, that they might bring us into bondage. Galatians 2:4. That's the word, bring us into bondage. That's our word right there.
God don't never change. He's God.
For our book review today in episode 319 of the podcast, I want to review Joe Rigney's new book, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage. Leadership and Emotional Sabotage. A few years ago, I had Joe on as a guest to Man Rampant, our talk show or sit down, talk through big issues show. And we spent some time talking about the distinction between sympathy and empathy. And following that show, there was an uproar. There were a number of people who were quite upset by it, which indicated to me that we were over the target. Sympathy is where the word means fellow feeling or feeling together with. So, and it's a word that's used in the New Testament. Our high priest, the Lord Jesus, is like us in every respect, except apart from sin. And this enables him to have sympathy with the people he's representing. So our high priest is sympathetic to us. He feels together with us. But this is the sympathy of a drowning swimmer is floating by in the, or not quite floating by, that's why he's drowning. He's going by the bank in the river, going down for the last time, and someone on the bank throws him a rope or grabs a tree limb and leans out over the water and extends a hand. So that is sympathy. Sympathy recognizes the other person's plight and keeps a sure foot on the bank in order to be able to pull him out. So there's an objective reality, there's an objective check, which is the riverbank, and then there's the plight that the person is in, which is the fact that he's drowning. So someone who's sympathetic is someone who has one foot on the bank and one hand extended out over the water. Empathy, in our age, empathy has sort of become the prime directive. And empathy means there has to be no judgment at all of any kind. So whatever the person's feeling, that feeling has to be validated. That feeling has to be affirmed. And you can't say, well, maybe if you let me pull you up on the bank here, we could dry you off. That would be hinting that their behavior or their condition is less than ideal. So what empathy does is takes a header into the river alongside the person who's drowning and proceeds to drown together with them. And since that time, Joe has called this form of empathy untethered empathy. And this is to distinguish it from, since empathy has gone out into the world, a lot of people just use empathy in the rough and tumble of day-to-day life. A lot of people just use empathy as a synonym for sympathy. Oh, he's got real empathy. They just mean he's got real sympathy. But the definition of empathy being driven by the therapeutic counselors is an empathy that demands that there be no judgment whatever. All right, so that episode of Man Rampant sort of brought everything out in stark relief. Joe and I have been talking about these sorts of issues for some time. This is because of our mutual interest in the writings of Rene Girard and our mutual interest in the writing of Edwin Friedman, who was a Jewish rabbi who wrote Failure of Nerve, a very insightful book. And so what Joe has done in this book is he has taken all of these issues, the issues of empathy, the issues of emotional sabotage, this is something that Friedman talks about, the issues of mimetic envy and striving and rivalry that you read about in Gerard. And he's taken them all and put them in an expressly biblical framework and written it all out for leaders in positions where this sort of thing happens. These leaders might be leaders in parachurch organizations or pastors of churches or editors at publishing houses or managers of, a chain of blogs, whatever. Whenever you have people gathering together, you're going to have comparisons, you're going to have competition, you're going to have rivalries, you're going to have envy. In Christian organizations, that envy can and should be dealt with by means of making the cross of Christ central, but that can't happen, and this is where Joe's book comes in. That can't happen unless there is a leader in the middle of it who is willing to be differentiated, who's willing to go against the emotional currents that are swirling around whatever controversy it is. This is a small book. It's a quick read, but it is a absolute necessity for any Christian in leadership. Leadership and Emotional Sabotage by Joe Rigney.